Hello, and welcome to the Operational Arch, Season 2, Episode 22, where we'll be discussing the space domain and the final frontier.
We're in an interwar period now, and we could call it post-conflict or pre-conflict, and I think MDO is a step in the right direction. The new JP-314 is a step in the right direction.
Hello, welcome to the Operation Arch, bridging the gap between strategy and tactics, and the official podcast of the School of Advanced Military Studies at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. I'm Major Jesse Vise, who will be acting as moderator for a unique episode with the trifecta of experienced space professionals. Our guest today is Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Drew, an assistant professor in the Department of Joint International Military Operations at the Command and General Staff Officer Course, as well as the senior instructor for the space curriculum. He is a 2017 Art of War Scholar, a 2018 graduate of the School of Advanced Military Studies, and is currently working on his PhD in space resources from the Colorado School of Mines. Among his many space assignments, Lieutenant Colonel Drew served as a member of the planning teams that established the U.S. Space Command and U.S. Space Force. He has published nearly two dozen articles, book chapters, conference papers, and one science fiction novel. His co-authored nonfiction book, The Battle Beyond, How to Fight and Win the Coming War in Space, is available for pre-order now. Major Aaron Castle Warren, who some of you have met before, is part of our core podcast team and will be wearing his U.S. Space Force hat today. Aaron's background is in missile warning. Aaron graduated from the 328 Weapons Squadron Space Superiority Weapons Instructors course in 2016, then transitioned to integrating space effects into air operations planning. Notably, he served as a key counter-Iran planner at the Air Force's Air Operations Center in Qatar and instructed operational planning for 3 years at the Air Force Weapons School. Finally, we have Major Brian Hamill joining us from this year's student body of the Advanced Military Studies program. Brian has been a civil affairs officer for the past 7 years under 1st Special Forces Command. His last assignment was at the 95th Civil Affairs Brigade Civil Knowledge Integration Chief, where he worked to integrate the outputs of the Touchstone Brighton and the Army Space Cadre Basic Course into civil affairs reporting mechanisms. Earlier this year, Brian transferred to the Functional Area 40 Space Operations Officer. Brian's a graduate of the CGSE's Information Advantage Scholars Program. He has briefed his work to the Irregular Warfare Center, and a distilled version of his thesis will be published early next year in Military Review and Special Warfare Magazine. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to have you all here today. We're excited to talk about space as a warfighting domain and how the Advanced Military Studies program has been or will be efficacious in influencing your careers. So, Colonel Drew, for you, first question goes to you. We've had many exceptional guests on this podcast, but your skills and experiences make you unique among Army officers. We read some of those in the introduction, but can you talk a little bit about your background and experiences and how your time at SAMS became a part of that to shape you into the officer that you are today?
Yeah, sure, Jesse. Thanks. Great to be here. You know, I started out as a young armor officer with the Future Combat Systems Program back in 2007. Really interesting experience, a lot of futuristic kind of thought, a lot of capability development, doctrine development, looking at things from a sort of non-conventional perspective. And I don't mean in the unconventional war kind of way, but in the, you know, back then we were looking at what the future Army would look like in terms of large-scale combat operations and what that would mean in an environment that was very different from the current operating environments of Iraq and Afghanistan. So taking that forward, I left the Army community, became a space operations officer in the first voluntary transfer incentive program in 2010. So I've been doing space now about over 13 years. And so from there, it was one interesting experience after another. You know, it was, hey, what does this all mean? How do we do this? What does space mean to the Army? And struggling really to kind of answer those questions for myself and for other military professionals was what really led me to try and write down these ideas. And so when I got to the Command and General Staff College, I had the opportunity to be an Art of War scholar. I started looking at the Army's role in space operations going clear back until about from 1938 to 1958 specifically, which is a lot earlier of a time frame, I think, than most people would assume the Army was involved in space-related military activities. So that got me thinking. I had a chance to go on to SAMS. So while I was at SAMS, I did my monograph on operational art and space systems. And that really got the ball rolling and had the chance to apply some theoretical principles, had the chance to study in depth, had the chance to look at modern warfare and what the directions we thought that those activities were going to go. And from there, I started fleshing out these ideas. I think the one moment that comes to mind was about probably 6 years ago. I was at the Space Operations Officer Forum in Colorado Springs, and we were talking about, hey, what? How do we get this language right? You know, how do we talk about these things? How do we make this meaningful to the wider audience? How do we make the traditional Army officer who's gone through a traditional career path understand what space operations means and how to talk about it? Because it's often been treated like this esoteric discipline, something that's completely different from the common experience. And I don't really think I don't really think that view is valid anymore, or maybe not acceptable. And that's really why I wrote the book. So to try and communicate to people in ways that the majority of the military, the Army, the Navy, the Marines, the Air Force, will understand, hopefully.
So, Castle, to build up on what Colonel Drew just mentioned, what have you seen as a space operations officer in terms of planning, and how do you think AMSP will augment these skills?
Yeah, so I thought it was sort of interesting, Colonel Drew, whenever you sort of mentioned this idea of transferring over in 2010 and trying to articulate the way that space reinforces or affects Army operations and sort of trying to carry that information and carry that sort of torch forward. I would say that the Space Force is doing a very similar thing, and in which case, like, you know, we stepped out originally from the Air Force. We're still Department of the Air Force, but it is still very much focused on what can we do to produce effects via the use of the space domain. What I've really enjoyed about the AMSP program so far is just the idea that it is sort of an outcomes-based approach to operational planning. And so the Air Force has Air Force TTPs where they talk about operational planning or effects-based sort of tactical planning, and then you step up to the operational level, which we focus quite a bit more on the JP, or the Joint Publication 5.0. And I would say that that's where we focus most of our planning. So it's been interesting as a Space Force member to see the FMs, or the field manuals, in relation to the joint publications. It's really given me an opportunity to see how I can better integrate space moving forward.
Awesome. So great perspective, especially on the doctrinal side in your experience. Brian, can you talk a little bit about why you transferred from civil affairs to the Functional Area 40 career field? And where do you think AMSP will be value-added going forward?
Yeah, Jesse, and I appreciate you and the team having me on. To Castle and Colonel Drew's point, I think it comes back to articulating effects. And what I mean by that is about mid-2021, General Braga, the commanding general for USASOC, comes out with this idea called the Triad, and it's supposed to be this symbiotic framework between USASOC, between SMDC, between our cyber, so between General Barrett, General Carbler, and General Braga, where you have these effects, these symbiotic relationships that go back and forth between these three equities. And what I noticed was under USASOC, we have an entity called SWIC, the Special Warfare Center and School, which is under General Pear. He used to be the Deputy Commander for Space and Missile Defense Command. And there are two different cyber courses under SWIC, and so going through those, I think I better understood what General Braga wanted. But then as I looked to the space domain, SWIC didn't have any space education. And so I had to kind of scour kind of the DOD to look for some space education, found it in Colorado, convinced my Brigade 3 to give me a couple grand in TDY to go figure this out. And I go to the space course and I learn a little bit about orbital mechanics and space operations. Well, come early 2022, USASOC has this big OPT, this enormous planning session, and there's a variety of different OPTs, and the two FA-40s assigned to 1st SFC were both on different OPTs, and I got tasked out to lead this sub-OPT focused on the space domain, and I remember feeling kind of useless and helpless because there was no one really there to help guide what I had learned and try to manifest and tangentially apply what I had learned at these courses into what General Braga and General Engel were looking at. And so I figured kind of the best way to see this come to fruition all the way was to kind of transfer to be value added. Having been under 1st SSC the last 7 years, There aren't many FA-40s that have been in the soft community and then have kind of switched to the FA-40 community, so I thought this was the best way to support smaller units of action.
Go ahead.
Do you remember what the, was it Space 100, Space 200, Advanced Space Warfighters course?
So it was the Army Space Cadre Basic course, and I remember it being very value-added, but I remember it left there was still a hole in my education. I couldn't quite figure out where SOF's responsibility or SOF's contribution was to this. And so when people articulate the triad, it's the three different equities, space, cyberspace, and SOF, and there's like two directional arrows between there, and people can easily articulate SOF receiving effects from space, but I wanted to look at it the other way. How can SOF affect the space domain? How can SOF contribute to space warfare?
Thank you for that, Brian. That's actually a great segue for Colonel Drew's next question. You talked a little bit about you wanted to contribute more through the soft background into space, and you really just figured it out. Not everyone has the opportunity to just get a couple thousand dollars and go TDY. So, Colonel Drew, you as the only space operations officer instructing in the entire college, what do you think about the Army's future of space operations, especially now that we have newly published multi-domain operations doctrine, and how are you passing on the word of how to make space operations more holistic instead of esoteric, as you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, Jesse. I think, like Brian and Castle say, you know, there's a lot of people who want to embrace space operations, want to understand it more deeply. They just don't quite know how. And I think that starts at the very lowest level and goes probably just about to the top of the Army. People are looking at concepts. You know, we've got the triad, which I understand the Secretary of the Army has embraced, I'm told, secondhand. The SpaceCom has embraced the triad concept, so it's grown into something, it's growing into something that's a little bit more than just a three-star good idea, right? And I think that's important right now because there's a lot, it's not just the Army that's struggling with how to incorporate space into its everyday activities, right? It's the Joint Force, it's all the combatant commands. There's redefinition of roles and responsibilities. Missions are going crazy all over the world, and it's this question of what direction do we want to go. You know, we're in an interwar period now, and we could call it post-conflict or pre-conflict, but we're in an interwar period now, and I think MDO is a step in the right direction. The new JP314 is a step in the right direction. The multi-domain task forces are probably a step in the right direction, you know, for the Army. We'll see how those all play out, but there's a lot of discovery work that has to happen. There's a lot of creative and critical thought that needs to go into what space means for the Joint Force. I remember having a conversation with my co-author, Paul Szymanski, and great guy, you know, very experienced. And I said, you know, I think fundamentally the infantry has been around for 10,000 years, but space operations really, really hasn't been around that long. Maybe longer than some people think, you know, certainly before the first Gulf War, right? That kind of gets the tagline of the first space war. But, you know, we've been doing all these things for the better part, 70 years or more. And all those things that we have in 1991 historically are the things that grew up out of the necessities of Vietnam and even earlier. So there are things out there. There's a lot of opportunities for individuals to develop. You know, as Brian said, you kind of got to go out and look for it yourself. There's quite a bit written over the years, and whether that's in Air University Press publications, Military Review, there have been a handful of very good theses and monographs over the years coming out of this institution, out of the Naval Postgraduate School, out of Air Force Institute of Technology. So one of the things I was trying to do was synthesize all that a little bit and say, hey, what do we really need to know from a warfighting perspective? How do we explain space to somebody who's maybe a land domain expert or a maritime domain expert in a way that they'll understand? So I hope the book can contribute to some of that. And if it doesn't, I certainly hope other people keep writing about the subject and putting their ideas forward. I'd like to put out a plug for Major Dennis Rice right now, who's out at Space Forces Indo-PACOM, so one of the component commands that's standing up within the Space Force. And Dennis just had a Schriever paper published on a deterrence framework for space. So I think that was a really great product he came up with. And, you know, I'm really proud of him for contributing to the discussion in that way. So the things are out there. The opportunities for knowledge are out there. They're just maybe not as well defined for us right now.
So Aaron, having grown up in the Air Force and Space Force, how does your view differ from Colonel Drew's viewpoint of space?
Yeah, so first of all, I'll also throw out a plug for Dennis Rice's work, as well as any Guardians who find themselves listening to this. Dennis had a great opportunity to come to CGSC and take the time to write a fantastic thesis through his Art of War scholars. And so if you're thinking about going to CGSC over maybe another service school, as someone who went through both and has a Space Force background, I would highly encourage you to think about going to CGSC. That's just my Aaron Warren's personal opinion. What I thought was interesting of your point, sir, is you mentioned the first space war being that is well thought of as Desert Storm, but then you brought it back before that. I thought you mentioned Vietnam, and it's not a full-fledged thought that I have, but it's interesting because my mind immediately went to the Cold War, honestly, being that first deal. And then I immediately sort of pivoted to the idea of this great power competition and how we had these other wars that were happening throughout that were in the vein of great power competition through proxy forces. But it really goes back to this idea that space is very much a strategic element or strategic force that has far-reaching implications. And so where Colonel Drew has done a fantastic job of articulating the way that ground forces can better understand space, I view my responsibility as a guardian of providing some level of understanding there, but realistically leaning into understanding space domain writ large and providing expertise inside of the domain. And so where I wouldn't expect me to walk into a planning cell and be the land expert, I would be the space expert, and I should be contributing information as well as effects that only I can provide, and being able to articulate just sort of at the high level, if say we're talking at a classified level above what we can talk about inside that room or that OPT.
Great perspective. So you kind of mentioned that it's more of at the strategic level. Brian, you having a soft background, special operations forces typically have tactical actions with strategic implications. So what do you think is soft view of space in MDO?
Yeah, no, this is a good question. I certainly don't want to speak for the entire USASOC enterprise, but there's a PhD over in Great Britain named Blendon Bowen, and he talks about humans will always be involved in space power. And it took me a few months to kind of wrestle with that. But if you consider the space domain itself is kind of broken down into three different segments, the actual space segment or the orbital segment, the link segment, which is typically transmissions of data, and then the ground segment. I think SOF's value proposition is in that ground segment. And so if you really look at it from an irregular warfare perspective and consider it's not, yes, it's the capability on orbit you're trying to combat, but one layer deeper, it's the person behind it who's wielding that capability. And so can you map the physical, the logistical, the financial infrastructure, the logistics infrastructure behind the person making that decision? And can you create dilemmas to impede them from working that capability on orbit? That's something Colonel Drew kind of helped me flesh out, what I'm sure for him was a painful 9 months, and then opened about like 140-page thesis kind of explaining that. And with that, once you get to the actual person, once you consider their biases and heuristics and their decision-making process, then I think that's much more soft value proposition, especially with the SIOP community.
And Aaron, how does the idea of commercialization change the view of warfighting for Space Force in comparison to, say, ground forces?
When we sort of talked about this prior to the podcast, I was trying to think of a better way to think about the use of military force. And I would say when we think about the Army's use of force, we really do think about ground forces, invasion of a country, or at least maybe stability operations within a country. Whereas I think space operations has to view it more as almost a naval proposition where you're protecting the global commons and movement through and from a domain. And so when you think about warfighting, you think about the commercialization of space as more and more of our citizens, as more of the global commons use space, just like we use the Straits of Malacca or other things to to ship massive amounts of consumer goods. We're also using space to ship, if you will, massive amounts of data. And that is, it is a requirement for the United States Space Force to protect the use of the space domain on behalf of the United States its citizens and the United States allies and partners. And so there's this view that becomes much different when you think about protecting a global commons. We'll end it here. Other thoughts on that? Yeah.
No, I think I agree with what Castle said, and my mind was going back to his comment earlier on the Cold War and how we have, you know, space not just in support of large-scale combat operations, but space in support of the entire conflict continuum, and maybe simultaneously, right? Because it's this global enterprise, it's a global domain. There's all these activities going on that depend on, you know, maybe the same sensors, transmitters, spacecraft, whatever system. Maybe the same units are operating multiple missions for multiple theaters simultaneously. And maybe one of those is large-scale combat. Maybe one of those is, you know, some kind of low-level contingency operation or special forces employment. So I think there's an incredible onus right now on the Space Force to understand how all of their activities support all of the different joint operations that are going around the world, that are going on around the world. And that's a tall order. You know, that's something that even for, you know, field grade officers who are well studied in these kinds of questions, you really have to dig deep and try and turn it into a war fighting discussion rather than the customer service discussion, I think, was the traditional kind of way that the Air Force Space Command looked at it. And I think that the creation of the Space Force, the creation of Space Command are important inflection points in turning that culture in a slightly different direction.
To transition over to you, to Colonel Drew, one item I hear DoD personnel confuse quite often is the role of U.S. Space Force versus U.S. Space Com. Can you unpack those two equities and delineate the roles and responsibilities of each organization?
Yeah, sure. This is a discussion I have with all my majors that come through the staff college, because it's a common point of confusion, especially for officers who up to this point in their career have probably not been above a brigade or division level. So everything above that is kind of very nebulous and esoteric, right? So the Space Force, just like the Army, organizes, trains, and equips. It's a service. It provides those Title 10 United States Code service functions, right? So they are the ones providing forces to combatant commanders. Up to this point, mostly SpaceCom, but as I said, there's Space Force components standing up at other combatant commands, so that situation is likely to change as the Space Force grows. This Space Command is the unified combatant command for warfighting operations in and to space, right? So they have all of the missile warning mission, the satellite communications mission, the positioning, navigation, and timing mission, running the GPS satellites, all that stuff, all that satellite-based capability is out there. There's an electronic warfare piece to it. There's an orbital warfare piece to it. So anything that is an operational mission for space right now is mostly in the bailiwick of SpaceCom. And I say mostly because there are certain authorities, there are certain operations going on around the world that a geographic combatant commander or a theater commander might have command and control over, but that's all on a case-by-case basis.
I appreciate that. Great once over the world to kind of cover a discussion that we've been talking about today. And shifting focus over to your book, so its publication period was roughly 5 years. With all the changes in the realm of space security, what ideas are you excited about? Is there anything in your book that might already be overcome by the events over the last 5 years?
Yeah, so I think, you know, Paul Szymanski and I really put a lot of effort into refining ideas, taking into account the kind of current state of doctrine. Military theory is a little less prone to change, I guess, but the doctrine has changed quite a bit. So some of the doctrinal references we have in the book have already been superseded by other doctrinal publications, right? And I that doesn't invalidate the ideas necessarily, but it's just something that everybody needs to be aware of. You know, doctrine is constantly changing, and perhaps sometimes so much that the force can't catch up to it. Yeah, so what we're trying to do is baseline a lot of these ideas, create a set language, that is based on doctrine, that is based on traditional military theory. And this isn't a completely original idea, right? You have someone like Everett Dolman, who, coming from the Air Power School, writing about space operations 20 years ago and into the present. Someone like John Klein, who's from the Maritime School, right? So where Paul and I took it, and part of the reason he wanted to partner with me was because I come from the land domain school. So what does that look like? How does that allow us to bring in different perspectives, different ideas? And a couple of the things I'm really excited about are we talk about, you know, the joint functions in terms of space operations. You know, Brian mentioned effects. I think Castle mentioned effects. Effects are great. Effects are one element of operational art, right? So there's all these other kind of ideas out there that we wanted to pull the string on and try and help them become a little more mature. So it's got great pictures. We spent a lot of time on the visuals, on the graphics. Spent a lot of time trying to pull out ideas like stratagems, right? What do stratagems look like for space operations? What do the levels of war look like for space operations? How do we visualize these things? How do we visualize operational art, maybe in ways that aren't so conventional? But, you know, that looking at that little globe on a common operating picture with a bunch of little dots orbiting around it isn't really helpful. So there's got to be a better way, and Paul proposes a really good way that I think is probably one of the biggest ideas to come out of the book. So, you know, our goal is that anybody who picks it up can gain a better understanding of space warfare. And whether that's a, you know, Air Force Academy cadet or majors at SAMS, you know, I think it works. So really, really excited. Now, the second part of your question is what has already been superseded. So there are two things that come to mind. The first is we anticipated small satellite communications and swarm kind of behavior, but Starlink was not yet an entity when we finalized the script of the book. So I think Starlink and other systems like OneWeb or, you know, whatever future versions may come from future nations out there, I think those things are really going to change the landscape quite dramatically. And then the second thing that we didn't account for was the growth of Space Force Service Component Commands right off the bat, right? So that was a pretty fast organizational growth move. So I think that's going to change the way that SpaceCom and Space Force interact and how some of those authorities are spread out among the different global commanders.
Would you say that you think that the small amounts of missions that the combatant commanders currently have are going to likely be pushed over to the component commands, or do you think that those will still retain? I would love to hear how you think it would.
Yeah, no, I think the biggest challenge right now, and I remember having this discussion when we'd planned the establishment of U.S. Space Command throughout the summer, fall, winter 2018. And then spring 2019, we start planning Space Force. And I remember having the discussion in the planning room about, all right, we've only got so many people, right? The joint space community, if we look at Air Force Space Command, such as it was at the time, Army Space and Missile Defense Command, the Navy and Marine Corps contingents, there's only so many people. So when it came out that we were going to stand up a service, one of my prime concerns was, all right, we've only got so many deck chairs and so many ways to rearrange those deck chairs. How are we going to do both? And so trying to do both at the same time, I think, has led to a situation where focus is not solely on one or the other. And there are warfighting equities at stake, and there are institutional equities at stake. And right now, I don't think there are enough people to cover all the bases. So I think that's the risk. I think that's the strategic risk for military space, such as it is today.
My personal belief is, I agree with you.
So, gentlemen, you both answered the next question, which is proper command relationships in place to fight the future war. If you were to be a king for a day in the space world, what do you think is needed to ensure we can fight the future war in regards to command relationships?
One of the things I learned while I was at CGSC is the Army's respect for the commander and the commander's role in making on-the-fly decisions. I think there's been a giant push to bring down authorities to the lowest possible level, but I believe that space is still going to have to require C2 of certain assets at a strategic level in order to maintain global prioritization for our limited assets.
Command and control relationships are what planners fight about most, right? I think, in my experience anyway. So, it's interesting the way Air Force Space Command and then Space Comm and the Space Force are structured. I think there's a cultural artifact in the structure of the organizations where most everything is kind of under one main commander, the Combined Joint Force Space Component Commander. It's SJFSC now, or is it?
Yes, SJFSC.
So that commander, now a 3-star level commander, is really responsible for the vast majority of the space support missions. So whether or not those subordinate elements and those subordinate missions have like dependencies, it doesn't really matter, right? In an Army command and control structure, you build organizations based off units with like dependencies, and then you're able to kind of solve their problems and manage their problems through a limited span of control. That span of control problem is one of my concerns, and I was just talking about it with some people at Spacecom this week. Because there are small units like Castle was talking about that have a direct reporting chain right up to maybe a 2-star general. So that works in steady state operations, but my concern is what happens in a crisis environment. What happens when we've got a lot of different missions that have a lot of unique problems that aren't necessarily interrelated, and then that becomes a very complex task for that operational level commander who may not have the staff expertise, the depth of knowledge across the formation, or the time and capacity to deal with all those itty bitty decisions rather than having them distributed across a chain of command. So for what it's worth.
We talk about command relationships, and maybe this seems a little bit heretical. I've talked about this with Colonel Drew. If Spacecom is a 4-star equity, then it should have a TSOC, which doesn't make much sense right now when you consider the geographic combatant commanders are, you know, facilitating most of their own effects. But when you look at 50 or 60 years from now, is the moon going to be used as a potential staging base to Mars? Are the Chinese going to occupy it through a civ-mil fusion concept? What does that look like in terms of force posture? Are we ready for that? Understanding there are international norms and agreements that right now kind of prevent that, but I think there's a lot of gray space that our adversaries are going to look to exploit here in the next 50 years.
Yeah, I'll add, Brian, you know, just that's not as outlandish an idea as it may sound to, you know, the casual listener. The new JP314 talks about cislunar space, so the space between the Earth and the Moon as a potential area for the employment of military forces. So there's quite a bit of research and investigation going on into things that might happen. Maybe we can get better sensor coverage. Maybe we can get refueling capabilities, things like that, to increase the lifespans of our satellites. So it'll be interesting to see how that all plays out.
Yeah, great insight, gentlemen. And speaking of research, Brian, you're conducting some quite extensive research right now focused on sustainment-centered constellation. Can you talk a little bit more about your research and how that came to be?
Yeah, so the national security strategy that President Biden published in 2022 really directs us to look at China. And so when you look at the Indo-PACOM as a theater, one of the issues that constantly nags me is logistics. And we have a finite amount of ships, boats, of planes, of infrastructure to move men and materiel around the theater. And so one of the things, you know, Colonel Drew was really good at in terms of my education last year was having me look back at history and what have we historically done to solve some of these issues. And so in the 1960s, the U.S. had a program called the Corona Program. And the long and the short of it is when we were pushing spy satellites over the USSR, once the film capsules were developed, they would drop back down to Earth, and they were caught mid-flight by aircraft. And so I was thinking, well, instead of developed film capsules, can you do that with blood? Can you do that with money? Can you do that with 3D printed parts or material of choice? And nothing like that I found currently exists in terms of, you know, the literature available out there. But I thought, you know, instead of diverting a C-130 or a C-5 or a larger ship, a lot of people don't know that satellites can get as small as a shoebox nowadays. Can you have that travel and pass through the ionosphere back to smaller units of action that just may need a couple bags of blood or resupplied with a, you know, unique widget? And to Colonel Drew's point earlier, there's only about maybe a dozen to 20 prolific authors on space warfare right now. One of them is Dr. John Klein, and he came up with this idea called celestial lines of communication. So playing on the term that we've all grown up with in terms of ground lines of communication or sea lines of communication, he uses that same idea but extends it to the space domain. So can you have sea locks to enable the warfighters, considering, you know, one satellite in low Earth orbit passes over the same spot every 90 minutes? So I think that's a viable option that we need to explore here in the coming years.
This transitions great, actually, into our closing questions, which is, I'll start with you, Brian, since we're on you, is what do you think the future of space warfare will be?
Yeah, so going back to my earlier point, I've got quotes from the head of the Chinese exploration program, Yi Pia Jin, who talks about basically the moon being a marker in their international, I would call it international relations philosophy or warfare philosophy, but they're looking at that as a strategic point. And whether that's to harvest the helium-3 to provide safer nuclear energy or just as a drop point or a start point to get to Mars, I'm not entirely sure. But even the director of NASA came out earlier this year and kind of recommended to the congressional bodies that, like, this is part of China's national strategic aperture and it should not be ignored. So I've been kind of focusing on that in line with my monograph. So thanks.
Castle?
Yes, so I think you'll continue to see that the Space Force will continue to follow where humans go. And so if commercial exploration continues to push out into cislunar space or beyond, if that is contested, then the Space Force will have to provide some level, assuming directed by the government, the U.S. Space Force will have to provide some level of capability to defend against threats in those domains. Where I see and where I think we're going to continue on is the idea of orbital warfare and the idea of sanctuary space will continue to be talked about, and it will continue to be less and less benign inside of the environment. And so we have to start thinking about ways to do that rapid, sort of the rapid resupply, not just terrestrially, but also into space as well.
Colonel Drew?
Yeah, I think, let me say, first of all, I think we're behind in a couple key areas. So I think we're behind in electronic warfare / electromagnetic spectrum operations. I think we're behind in quantum. And, you know, it's sort of an interesting question of what does the future look like? And are we already too far behind to invest in some of the legacy technologies? Maybe now is a good time to just leap forward. And I would love to see us leap forward, you know, invest very heavily in cyber, very heavily in quantum technologies, quantum communications, quantum sensing, those sorts of things. And those are on different lists of priorities for different development efforts. But I think we're going to see a lot more of that, and it's going to be a lot faster pace, a lot more global, and warfare is going to be very continuous. There's going to be competition, conflict, maybe even all-out war, and all happening at the same time. And we're going to have the whole world as a stage to exert power.
And the last two questions reserved for you, sir, is what is your definition of Operation ARNT?
Oh, yeah. So I feel like I should give the doctrinal answer, but I don't know what the doctrinal answer is. But I struggled with this. And one of my favorite things about SAMS was that they let me struggle with this idea. But, you know, the synchronization of tactical action to achieve in whole or in part strategic objectives. So had a great discussion. He didn't think there was an operational level of war for space operations. So I disagree with that and wrote a whole chapter on it. So, yeah, I think all these classical ideas apply, and we should challenge ourselves to figure out how to apply them more effectively on behalf of the Joint Force.
And lastly, what book or books are you currently reading and why?
I just finished last night, I think it was called Twilight World by Werner Herzog. And it was about this Japanese soldier who, after World War II, he was given orders to stay and conduct the guerrilla war until someone came back and relieved him. And so 30 years later, he's still in the jungles of the Philippines conducting a guerrilla war. And he comes across this camper, and this college kid says, "All right, I'm going to go get your commanding officer. I'll be back in, 3 weeks." So he finds this major who gave this lieutenant the orders in 1944, brings him back, and the soldier finally stands down. But he gets this welcome reception by the Filipino army. He hands his samurai sword over to the president of the Philippines, who then hands it back. It's this very kind of old-fashioned honor, kind of, what does it mean to be on this quixotic kind of quest for which most people wouldn't see a purpose, but that was how he made meaning out of his life. So really great story.
Thank you, gentlemen, for the comments. It was a great discussion regarding space. It's going to be tough not to mix in an audio clip from Star Wars as part of our intro or outro today. We discussed everything from the ambiguity of space to removing the curtain of the esoteric skills within space and how we can make it holistic enough for every domain to have a basic understanding of the space domain. Space operations will happen in the spectrum of conflict continuum and can be executed at the tactical level with strategic implications. Not much different than the other domains. Gentlemen, thank you again for the conversation.
The views and expressions heard here are those of the authors and do not reflect the official position or opinions of SAMS, the U.S. Army, or the U.S. government. Stay up to date on all things SAMS by checking us out on Twitter at US_SAMS, Instagram at US.SAMS, and on LinkedIn. Additionally, if you have recommendations for an episode or wish to engage with us, please email us at operationalarch@gmail.com.